Welcome back to Season 9 of Talking with Traders. We're into the fifth year of this podcast that began in 2020. Once again, IG have come on board as the sponsor of the podcast. We're truly grateful to have such a global leader in online trading as our sponsors. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing various guests from around the globe on the topic of trading. Some of these will be past guests that we invite back onto the show, and some will be new guests. The idea is to attract a broad spectrum of different perspectives from various players in different areas of the markets. None of what you hear here is financial advice, but it is intended to get you thinking about how you might be able to apply what you hear here to your own trading and investing. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be notified when new episodes are released. Or if you watch these interviews on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and give us a thumbs up and leave a comment if you wish. We welcome the engagement. Once again, thank you to IG for sponsoring this podcast into its fifth year, and thank you, listeners, for your continued support. Now, let's get on to this week's interview. Welcome back to another episode of Talking with Traders. And this week, it gives me great pleasure to welcome back a past guest. He was with us in January of 2024, so not quite a year ago. But we always like to have good past guests back on the show if they've got a lot of insight to share. And in this case, our man, Frank Capillary from CapThesis, is in the hot seat today. Frank, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to have you back, man.
Hey, Garth, it is a pleasure. Thank you very much for welcoming me back. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. So, Frank, when we last spoke in January of 2024, I listened to the previous podcast that we recorded together just to get a little bit of context and so that we don't cover too much ground that we have already gone over. But at that stage, the market was kind of pushing to a new all-time high. S&P 500 had just broken above 4,800. At that stage, it was a new high, and it was looking quite overbought. But and the market was climbing a wall of worry, as I suppose it always does. And at that stage, I said to you, what do you think? What are you doing for the rest of the year? And it's quite simple. You just said, well, I'm going to just keep on doing what works. And I presume you've continued to do what works. The market has continued to climb a wall of worry throughout the rest of the year. We're now 20% higher. In fact, as I sit here right now, the S&P 500 is busy making a new all-time high, quite close to 5,800. So it's up more than 20% since we last spoke in January. It's continued to climb that wall of worry. But here we are. How's the year been for you to this point?
Yeah, well, thanks, Garth. It has been interesting in that respect because there's always something around the corner that could potentially, knock a trend lower. And along the way, things have changed, though. As we know, we have some big pullbacks. We had the first 6% drawdown in U.S. markets, from March to April, and then obviously a much bigger hiccup, if you will, from August to September. And so one of the reasons why, it was bullish back in January and remain now is that the market has shown the ability to digest this volatility every so often and regroup, form bullish patterns, right, and have those breakouts work. And so along the way, of course, it's kind of a pendulum. Sometimes you get overbought and oversold. And so what I try to base my analysis on is, is there a live bullish pattern in the S&P 500 out there? Do we have upside targets to key off of? And so along the way, from the last October low, we count now 9 different bullish patterns that have formed and have had their upside targets hit. But, in March, and again, in July, at those times, there were no more short-term patterns in play, meaning that we got to the extension that the market needed to regroup at some point to form additional formations like that to take advantage of. And, didn't call those pullbacks, but at the same time needed some sort of two-way market to pop up again and see how the market dealt with it. And so when that occurs, you sometimes then have the advantage of identifying even bigger formations. That's, of course, what happened from March to April and the breakout in early May. And then again, right now, right? Mm-hmm. We had to deal with that intense August volatility, and seeing how quickly that came back was historic, of course. But then the same thing happened this September. Now we can identify some very clear higher lows along the way, with each one of them representing, the bottom portions of bullish formations which I've taken advantage of. And so I'm not here to say this is always going to happen, but at the same time, we have to, number one, identify our market stance, one of those characteristics is, what is working? Are bullish patterns working, or are overbought in very overbought conditions being aggressively sold into and taken down to making lower lows, like we saw in 2022? As an extreme example, but I think very important and lucky for us, it's recent history as well. We see how different the markets have gone from 2021 through 2022 and into now. And so, for rest of the year, again, same type of thing. We know that October tends to be volatile, and we know they have a lot of news to get through. But for, the S&P and the other indices to take advantage of what's typically positive seasonality, I just think you need to see the consolidation phases continue to be resolved to the upside.
Okay, super. I mean, I look at a lot of your work that comes through, and I see it on the Daily Chart Report, which is an email. It's a free email service that Patrick Daniello runs. It's very good. If anyone listening to this podcast wants to subscribe to that, do so because it's free, and it just includes a lot of analysis from a variety of people. One of them is you. You're a contributor to that, and that's where I see a lot of your work. And I've noticed you've had a series of inverted head and shoulders patterns on the S&P 500 that you've opened higher targets each time. You've got quite a big target, if I'm not wrong, north of 6,000 on the S&P 500 based on the current pattern. Am I right?
That's right. And actually, it's 6,100, and it was actually put in play right when we talked last, Garth. It was a breakout through 4,800. And luckily, for the pattern and for our stance, is that we had a pretty immediate upside extension from there right until the end of March. So that created a lot of leeway, for the market to back and fill and keep that target in play. But so I've always talked about that as something that could potentially still happen. But what's important, of course, is what's happened in the interim now. And so, again, the market can do a lot of backing and filling, still stay above that level. Of course, the pullback from this point all the way down, there would be a pretty substantial down move at this point. But I bring it back to what happened or in 2020, 2021, it was a similar scenario. But we're up about 30 or 40% from the COVID lows by the time July came along. And at that point, another consolidation phase happened. We got a breakout, and that breakout target was about 32% above where the market was at that point. Got a lot of pushback in that as well, but the same scenario. As long as we see the ability of the S&P to digest any of those forthcoming corrective phases, then you still have that upside target in play. So as you know how that played out, S&P had 10% declines basically in September and October. Later that year, both of them held, had the election. And then just about 11 months after that target was set, it got hit. And so I bring that back to now because it's very similar. We're already up a lot from the 2023 low, even more so from the 2022 low. And anytime that happens, you have a target, say 20% or more higher, you're going to get a lot of pushback. And so I always treat it tentatively and say it is what it is. As long as it remains in play, we know nothing is a guarantee. But the ability to have that happen and numerous, bullish formations play out after that shows you how uptrends can form, right? Just you need the same thing to occur. And then we identify potential, changes of character when they pop up.
Yeah, super. So we are in an interesting time of the year now, from a seasonal perspective. And I kind of caveat this with saying that the seasonality hasn't really worked this year very well, from a perspective that September is seasonally a very weak month of the year for the market. And certainly coming into September, there were lots of analysts out there saying, look at the anagram of the previous 50 years, and the market goes down in September and it bottoms in October and then it rallies into the end of the year. Well, we didn't go down in September, we went up, and we're now into October. A lot of analysis out there right now is saying that if you look back at election years, the October leading into an election is typically weak. You see a little bit of pulling back in the market, and then it bottoms around about the time of the election and then rallies into the end of the year. Do you pay much attention to that kind of seasonality in your work? Does it feature, or is it just sort of noise?
Well, I always refer to it as a backdrop because it's good to know it's out there. And especially now, Garth, like you just mentioned, everyone knows about it. So on occasion, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But, in terms of where we are right now, wouldn't be surprised to see that, more volatility occur now, only because we haven't even entered earnings season yet. Market has slingshot back off from September lows. We know that everyone's watching, of course, every economic report, but especially now based on how the employment was better than we thought. And so the Fed has another, meeting in the same week that the U.S. election is happening. So I really don't like when people say there's so much uncertainty in the marketplace. You can't determine. There's always uncertainty. I guess when there is not, right, we get complacent. And so, but I try to always bring it back to what the price action is telling us. If you're at a seasonally, say, bearish or subpar time of the year, and you're also pretty extended, then there's maybe divergences in place that we pay attention to. When all those things line up, that's when seasonality matters most. Like you just mentioned, a lot of times it didn't work well, especially when the market has outperformed, this year. And just not forget too, we had a typical October-like pullback in August already. We've seen that time before. So maybe, the volatility that's gone through August and September could have taken the place of what typically happens in October, November. It would seem out of character based on the price action has gotten calmer over the last 2 weeks. That's when you think it should not, and bullish patterns are starting to work in front of earnings season, in front of all of these things. So we can't ignore the fact all of those factors are going on, but what we have to pay attention to is price action first. Sometimes that tells the story, whether we want to believe it or not.
Yeah, totally, totally. So part of what you said there actually tees up my next question quite nicely, because you mentioned the August volatility. And that was obviously, it was at the start of August. And I remember it quite well because I was actually away that week. And literally the way I went, the week I was away, the markets kind of fell out of bed. It was on the back of the yen carry trade when the Bank of Japan raised interest rates somewhat unexpectedly. And the yen strengthened, and all of a sudden there was massive short squeeze in the yen, and a whole bunch of other positions had to be liquidated. Basically, it resulted in a very rapid 10% pullback in the equity market, in the S&P 500, and much more than that for the Japanese market. Now, the question I have for you is that these kind of things kind of they come around from time to time, and they tend to shake out the weak hands. And I'll admit, in this case, I was one of the weak hands. I was long of a Japan ETF, and it broke all sorts of technical levels. And I thought, right, okay, the picture's changed. Technical supports have broken. I'm out, let's get out of here. And then this thing recovered very, very quickly in just a few weeks. And in fact, now I look at that same Japan ETF that I was long of, and it's close to basically nearly back at prior highs again. Now, I mean, I presume this might have happened to you at some stage in the past. It happens to the best of us, I suppose. But when you get a situation like that, where you get shaken out of a position and then it comes back in your favor, well, it would have been in your favor had you not been shaken out. What do you do in a situation like that? Do you just let it go and say, "Oh, well, I missed that one," or do you get back in as quick as possible? How do you deal with that kind of scenario?
Yes, great question. I think it's really, it tries on our emotions, right? And as much as we want to remove how we feel about a trade, it's impossible to do so. But as we were talking about, but before we got on air, I think you have to, utilize any type of way we can manage risk as possible, especially if we're active traders there. And so I try to look at it sometimes independently. Of course, it's happened to me before as well. But if you get, especially if you use a relatively tight stop, to prevent bigger downside, which of course we all should do. But to me, I'll look at a situation, especially a chart for this matter, and try to determine if the structure has really been altered that much. And sometimes when looking at a classical formation like a cup and handle pattern or inverse head and shoulders pattern, that could sometimes morph into something that looks a little bit different before it actually starts to work. And so I'll usually give it a benefit of the doubt, meaning that if it comes right back like that and it's still is in breakout mode, so to speak, put the trade on again, probably put the stop loss in the same spot. But then if it fails once more, that's probably it. Now, I would say that everyone looks at this differently. They could just move on to the next one. But again, it all depends on what type of trade you're doing, what your time frame is, how much you want to manage risk, and of course, that has to do with how much capital you have to deploy there. So, but again, the way I look at it is it really just has to do with the viability of the chart structure that I'm looking at.
Okay, interesting. I always think of Stephen Goldstein, who's been on this podcast twice as well, and I went on his high performance trader coaching program as well. And one of the things he mentions in this respect is that he found in his trading career that very often the trades that got stopped out and then very quickly recovered back above his stop loss to where he would have been back in the trade anyway, those trades ended up actually becoming really big winners. And to the point where he then did exactly what you said. Basically, you get back on the horse, get back in the trade, put the stop loss back where it would have been before, just put the trade back and give it a second chance. And in fact, those often worked out. So it's interesting to note and interesting to hear your answer. And certainly in this case of the Japan ETF that I was shaken out of, it would have been beneficial to actually employ that approach to just get back on and, reinstate the stop loss again. Anyway, I know, Frank, that you're more of a stocks and ETFs guy, and you don't really do much in the leveraged space, do you? Like no futures or options, any of that?
No, I don't. It's strictly stocks and ETFs.
Stocks, Delta One. Okay. So that kind of leads me to my next question in terms of position sizing then. If you're building a portfolio, what do you kind of set as a maximum for an individual position in a portfolio? And then leading on from that as well, if you have a position in a portfolio that's really performing very, very well, and we get these from time to time, and it's a nice problem to have, but where a particular stock in a portfolio becomes such a disproportionately large part of that portfolio that it's now like such a big overweight, it's totally lopsided, and you would never have a position on that big in, if you were setting out to build a portfolio. But now you've got this problem that one particular position has been so successful that it's become too big in your portfolio. What do you do in that case? Do you downweight the winner, or do you just try and run a trailing stop loss and let it run? Because I mean, many times I've seen in the past where if you downweight those types of positions, it actually becomes counterproductive. You almost sort of strangle your performance by cutting the winner, right? Or reducing the size of that big winner.
Yes. So I'll answer the second part of the question first. And I would say that is a risk because, as we always hear, right, we always talk about cutting the losers first. But what is even more difficult sometimes is letting the winners run, especially in an actively trading account. Right? It's easy to do so, or to say easier to do so, if it's, say, retirement money or something you don't look at. All of a sudden, you realize you've owned Apple for 10, 15 years and it's the best thing possible. But if you're looking at that every day, it's very difficult because you see the moves, you see how the pullback, especially with the August volatility we just dealt with, it looked like everything was going to go and start to crash, which didn't happen. And so I used a few different things. Sometimes maybe you just take a little bit off too if it gets too extended, or if it's a bigger position like that, a trailing stop loss is no problem at all, with that, because then you still capture more of what you would have if you just wanted to sell for the sake of saying that you've got a big gain, right? You want to let them run as much as possible. And again, very easy to say in hindsight. We can look back to say, the internet, boom and bust, and what happened to Cisco back then, so forth and so on. Getting from the very top to say below a 200-day moving average was like a massive move, right? So every situation is different. But in terms of positioning sizes, again, looking at the trading account, specifically, I try to get anything more than 5% at a time. And I say that sometimes will change in terms of getting to 5%, only because I'm sure you went through this numerous times as well, Garth. We're looking at a stock or any trading instrument that you're trying to find a spot to get in, and it just is not forming a pattern that you want to see. Maybe continues to trend higher, but you have very high conviction in it. So what I would do there is maybe take a half or even to a third of what I want to do with it, just to make sure get in there just in case it continues to rally without pulling back, with the thought probably going to pull back at some point. So then, again, looking at the technicals, where's the right spot for that to occur? And this is where I'll put a buy limit. So make sure I get that, and then we'll see what the average price is. At that point, hopefully get to 5%, and then deal with it that way.
Okay. All right. Super. And just sticking with the sort of topic of risk management, and not really sizing positions, but risk management. You mentioned that you don't do any futures options. So you never put on any hedging tools in the form of futures or options or anything. Do you then therefore view just diversification as a sufficient risk management tool along with stop losses? Is that it?
That's part of it. But I think also we have, all of us have the ability to, say, use ETFs that are, inverse ETFs as well,
Right.
or volatility ETFs. And so what I'll sometimes do is, as a hedge, as for instance, if, have a lot of longs on, then maybe they're all with one area because it's outperforming, but then you see things getting overextended. And, one way to potentially squeeze alpha out of that is, buy volatility ETF or more of the, so many of the inverse ETFs, whether they're S&P 500, NDX, semiconductors, and kind of this that we talked about before, where you're probably going to sacrifice a little bit on the upside if that turn never comes. At the same time, you don't want to sell your current, holdings. That's a ways to potentially, create an additional, level of income on a very short-term basis if things do pull back. And, as we've seen so far this year, of course, those pullbacks have been relatively temporary. So the question is, of course, now, do you put a stop loss on that at some point, right? Which the answer is yes. But that's the only way, really, I hedge, in terms of, from that perspective.
Okay. But it's an interesting answer because you're right. I mean, there are so many different ETFs and inverse ETFs and leveraged ETFs in the US that you're quite right. You don't necessarily need to use futures and options to create the hedge because, as you mentioned, you've got all of these different ETF products that actually can do it for you quite simply, really. The last time we spoke, Frank, one of the topics we came up with at the end of the conversation was around books, and we spoke about some of the classic books, The Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, and How I Made $2 Million in the Market by Darvas, Nicholas Darvas, I think it is. These are classic books that were written many decades ago. I mean, that Darvas book, I think, was written probably 50, 60 years ago, if not longer. Maybe 70 years ago. Reminiscence is over 100 years old now. And yet those principles in those books are still absolutely as valid today as they were, several decades ago when those books were written. And we touched on the fact that it's because human nature doesn't change. Human nature has never evolved. And those human emotions that drive markets are still very much in play today as much as they were back then. Now, the question I'm coming to you with all of this kind of background is with the advent of AI and generative AI coming our way, do you think there's a chance that this finally changes where these things that this human nature that has driven markets for, hundreds of years starts to change because there's now AI that's a step ahead, generative AI that kind of thinks faster and smarter than human beings? Do you think it's possible?
I hope not.
Yeah, so do I. Otherwise
Because,
we're all out of a job, right?
yeah, exactly. But I mean, I would take a step back too and recognize the fact that trading has changed so much just over a decade. It obviously does, and all the way back 100 to see what it was there, or with the New York Stock Exchange, what it was in the 80s, with the advent of initially going from, fraction trading to decimals and having those spreads shrink so much, taking all the money out of now the broker's hands, where they could just, trade back and forth in the spreads forever. When that stopped, they thought Wall Street was dead, right? Now, from Wall Street and a firm advising the, so many times that changed, and kept on saying, though, the firm probably has, not too much left going forward. But that never happens either. And so I would like to look at AI as just another innovative, part of technology, and realizing from trading, you always have in the art part of it. Technical analysis is that, specifically where, you utilize, screens and whether it's AI or another, form of technology to help us identify opportunities better. But we can't, I don't think we should have, the computers choose those things for us unless we have specific parameters that they're spitting out for us, right? Just 2 days ago, I was on Instagram, for instance, and I got an ad from an AI app that could identify patterns, right? So my life was basically identifying patterns for clients and trying to pick trades off of it. And so I was interested in it, seeing it, of course, if it could possibly help. But the amount of data that it pushed out saying there's, the percentage of time this works out 32.5, if it's below a certain moving average, less, it was just an overwhelming amount of things where it, if we focus on that type of tool, I just think it makes it even more difficult in that matter. We can go on access
Okay.
to, but sophisticated traders only use a certain set of tools. Going back to, market wizards, right? No trader, no matter how successful, is going to utilize all the different, tools that they have available to them, either fundamentally or technically, and do well with them. We obviously go through a lot of these and determine which one is right for us and take it from there.
Yeah. Okay. Super. We lost the line a little bit during that, but I think we got the gist of it. I don't know whether that's the hurricane doing its work down there in the southern part of the States, but I think we got the gist of it in any case. Frank, on your website, you've got 10 core values that you live by, and I really love them. And actually, when I was preparing for this podcast, I almost wanted to just discuss the 10 core values because I think that there's a conversation to be had around each of those things. They're so good and powerful, and to flesh them out would have actually made an interesting conversation on its own, but maybe we can do that another time. But core value number five on your website is be disciplined. And to that point, you say any rules-based process is better than no process at all. Now, from my experience, many of them with retail clients, DIY traders and investors, they have no rules, no rules whatsoever. And hence they get the terrible statistics that, 70% plus of clients who trade leveraged instruments end up losing money. Can you take me through a little bit of the discipline that you follow in your process? Do you have a specific, like a weekend routine or morning routine that you follow to try and like that is repeatable day in and day out? For the way you analyze the market and the way you prepare for any given day.
Yes. First of all, thank you very much for saying that. Those core values are very important to how I run the business, and really a lot of them how applies to life as well. And so I think the biggest thing, considering where we are in today's day and age, is try to eliminate noise as much as possible. And not to sound overly preachy, but just getting as many notifications turned off as you possibly can from things we don't really need is a big help. And I'll just speak from experience. I turned off notifications from X slash Twitter about a year ago, and I probably missed 98% of what was coming in from that point, but I'm very happy that I did, because it's just overwhelming amount of things, especially if you're trading all day long. And maybe there's a few interesting points there, but for the most part, it's just noise, right? A lot of people talking back and forth. And so as much as you can eliminate that, as much as possible. And there's so many useful websites out there. One of the things I did a number of years back was just try to set up a spreadsheet, basically tied to an API to some of the sites, and just have the information pumped in that I want to see already there, as opposed to always going out and find something, because number one, it saves time. Number two, again, once you get on a site or anything else, it's very hard to avoid things that you don't want to see, right? Or that you don't need, for that matter. So I think a lot of these systems that we set up, Garth, it's about people realizing that it takes time to get a system, to get a set of rules in place. But once you have it set, it saves you so much time. So it may take, a week or so to get it done, but then it saves you 2 hours a day, all right, to understand. And so in terms of, one of the reports that we put out that the clients really like is called Chart Trades. So that's just giving specific trading ideas based on charts, with entry, exit levels, both targets, stop losses. And for that type of thing, as a for instance, I'll utilize two different ways of doing that. Very simply, just looking at a large universe of names, trying not to look at the actual symbols, looking for targets, or looking for, I should say, patterns that appeal to me, write them down, what they are, and then identify, and then go further into that. And as well as having some screens set up. But the same thing is, getting back to the AI conversation, that can, cull a universe down from 1,000 names to say 100. But really, that's where the work starts. Then you have to go into the weeds and look for that. So Along the way, younger traders, younger viewers may think all this is overwhelming, but eventually you get to the point where you know what you want to look for, right? Peter Brand, I think we talked about before, one of my favorite technical analysts and obviously successful traders. He was once asked at a CMT symposium, which I was in the audience of. Someone asked, "So, how long does it take you to identify whether you want to, buy or sell a stock or commodity based on the chart?" He said, 2 seconds, right? And so we all know if we look for a chart pattern, it may look appealing to us or not. At the very least, you write down the ones that after 2 seconds look appealing to you, then you go back and investigate it further.
Yeah, it reminds me of that intuition that they talk about in the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. It's a
That's
great
right.
book, and it talks exactly about that, the whole thing of if you're experienced, then you've got an experienced eye and you're looking for, in this case, chart patterns. If that chart pattern literally jumps off the page at you, if you know what you're looking for, and you know, because you just know when you know. So it's great that Peter Brandt had an answer like that. 2 seconds, I love it.
Yes, the
And
best.
I love what you said there about trying to eliminate the noise, because you're right. There's so much noise out there. There really is. I think I fall victim to this from time to time. I mean, I subscribe to a hell of a lot of things, and I probably should cut a whole lot of them, because they create so many contradictory opinions, which can mess with your head a bit. So to try and sort of cut it out, and as you say, just stick to your rules and be diligent about your rules, really, really does help. Frank, we're getting towards the end of our time, so I just want to give you an opportunity as we draw to the close now to just tell us a bit more about Cap Thesis and exactly what you do there. How listeners to this podcast can access your work if they want to see it, subscribe. Just give us a rundown of what you get as a client, as a subscriber to your Cap Thesis product.
Thanks a lot, Garth. Well, CapThesis now is 2 years old, so I like to call it technical analysis for professionals. So people that have an interest in the market, many of my clients, institutions, financial advisors, or again, people that have a keen interest in the markets themselves. And so what I would say the best way to find, all the different products that we have offered there is just through the website, capthesis.com. We're also on all the different social networks, either CapThesis or Frank Capillary, including YouTube, X, LinkedIn, so forth and so on. And so what I try to do with CapThesis is, again, take what I did on Wall Street. I worked with, between my different years there as a sales trader on the sales side and research. So along the way, I got to talk to, I had the fortunate luck of talking to buy-side traders, buy-side analysts, and portfolio managers along the way. So developed a keen understanding of what, the people that were really making the biggest decisions and driving the market wanted to see and how they wanted it delivered. And over the last 2 years too, that's really tried to lock that in a little bit more. So that's why there's different products there. Again, mentioning one of them is just individual stock trades, right? Just based on charts. So that's obviously a huge demand nowadays. And for more, seasoned traders, there's a pre-market piece that looks at S&P 500 strategy, opening look, right? We look into the weeds of what's going on the S&Ps in terms of price patterns and some of the daily statistics that sometimes we try to identify short-term swings, or we can even before we see it on the chart. And that gets into, internals, that gets into how the market closes every day. And of course, new highs, new lows. And we also have 175 ETF universe that we look at and identify the actionable charts, whether they come from the sectors, different asset classes, so forth and so on. And then for the higher tier membership, we also look at different time frames, right? To really, round out the information. So again, we go from looking at intraday type variations of what the S&P is doing to weekly and monthly charts. Again, looking at the major indices and also all the ETFs and different asset classes. And then, of course, on videos. Now, we do have a YouTube channel, which I spend most of the time just looking at from a high level perspective once a week. But the videos that our clients receive are, get much more into the weeds of what's going on,
Love
across our premium pieces. And obviously, just go more into the details. And then that's rounded out by having a monthly webinar as well. So that's a much more longer form between, say, 45 and 60 minutes. And the most recent feature that we're rolling out right now, having a community Slack channel for all the high level clients who want to take all everything that we've had there, and of course just see a more interactive experience between me and some of the other members.
Okay, brilliant, excellent. Well, go check it out, audience. It's your work is very authentic. I really do enjoy it. And as I say, the 10 core values on your website really stand out for me as something very genuine and very authentic. And we didn't do it at the start of this webinar, this podcast, because we did it previously when you and I spoke. But just to give some of your background, I mean, I know you had 22 years on Wall Street in a big firm. You've got CFA, CMT. You're a guy with a lot of experience and a lot of academic qualifications behind you as well. So as a retail trader or as any sort of DIY investor, to have access to somebody like yourself for a subscription price is an absolute it's well worth it, I would say.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate it. And, being associated with you on your podcast, that of course has a lot of respect, means a lot. And again, being invited the first time was outstanding. Being, having the opportunity to come back a second time has been even better.
Yeah, super, Frank. Well, it's been excellent chatting to you, as I knew it would be. Thank you so much for your time. And yes, hopefully we do this again in another year's time or so.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Garth.
Cheers. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Talking with Traders, sponsored by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a strong global provider of online trading services as our backer for this podcast series. Remember to subscribe for more episodes by clicking on the subscribe button of your favorite podcast app, or if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, give us a thumbs up, and leave a comment. We welcome the engagement. Till next time.